On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, more reaction to the Rafael Devers trade that shook the baseball world. Devers has been introduced in San Francisco. We react to that press conference, and then we bring on a special guest. It's June Lee, who wrote a great story for Yahoo Sports this week about the big picture of the Boston Red Sox and how they got here. Then we will talk about Shohei Ohtani pitching again. That was pretty cool. And tell you what we've seen in our respective locations this week. I am at the MLB Draft Combine. Jake in Omaha at the College World Series. Give a little bit of taste of what we've seen so far there. And then, it's Baseball Barbacast. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world with alignment. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and we're aligned. We got to alignment.
Yeah, I would say that's honestly probably one of our greatest strengths as a baseball
duo
is we're usually on the same page. And as you hear our conversation with special guest June Lee later on in this episode, you will understand that that is not necessarily a strength, even when the stakes are far higher and way more people are literally and emotionally invested in what is going on. Jake, it is early on Wednesday morning, and I am in Phoenix, Arizona for the MLB Draft Combine. You are in Omaha, Nebraska for a few more hours.
And Rafael Devers is in San Francisco, California, and that will be
sure
the crux.
Is.
Of this sure, episode, Devers had his sure first is. Game last night with the Gigantes. He had his press conference in Giants Orange. We had Sam Kennedy and Craig Breslow doing a Zoom press conference on Monday afternoon after we recorded. We got Big Poppy talking about Devers. We're going to get into all of that. We're going to talk to June a little bit more about the big picture goings on of the Red Sox. And then we'll tell you what we've been seeing from the Combine and the College World Series. I saw a no-hitter.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Pretty cool. And Ohtani pitched. All of that. And probably no more because we won't have time for any.
But let's start. Our opener, this podcast, is Rafael Devers. He is on the Giants, folks. I know you normally laugh at me when I'm like interested to watch press conferences in the off season when players are being introduced. I just like to see what the first words are being said, especially, you know, sometimes you're hearing from like owners who never speak publicly, how GMs talk about things. This, I think both of these cases, both the Red Sox, you know, explaining to people why they traded Rafael Devers and the Giants holding again, it's just very weird to see an event like this in the middle of June, right? You know, you're used to these kinds of press conferences with the owner and the GM and the fancy and the huge, huge welcome. Like that doesn't even, it's funny because like
the long table.
Yeah. The long table, the dais, right? If you're a Yankee, sometimes it happens like right at the deadline, but normally that's so chaotic that like, there's not even really time for that. It's just like, go, go, go. You got traded. Boom, we go. But like this with the off day, we can kind of build up to like this event, which is essentially introducing Rafael Devers as a Giant for like the long term, right? Like that's, it felt more like a free agent acquisition because they are assuming this contract. And I think that was what was so interesting about the energy, let alone what was said during the presser, which we can get into. But unlike sometimes big trade deadline acquisitions who are like rentals, where it's like, oh my God, we got this guy and he'll be here for 2 months and then he'll probably leave. Like this was a massive moment for the franchise, and they treated it as such because, as we've talked about with them, they've wanted to be holding more press conferences like this over the past few years and have failed to be able to execute them.
Well, you had all the players coming up to watch, right? Yeah. And yeah. Devers is going to be under contract with the Giants longer than all of those players.
Okay. Yes, that's
probably going to be there longer than Bob Melvin, the manager who was up there. And so the atmosphere of it did feel like a free agent signing. There was so much clapping going on. They brought Barry Bonds out to sit in the front row and hang out with Rafael Devers, which was a fascinating choice.
I feel like Barry Bonds brought himself out there. I feel like Barry kind of moves in whatever ways that he wants. I don't, and he's around a lot, is my understanding also. So anyway, but yeah, it was an event. And I mentioned the press conference. It's like, remember, this is the team that had the Carlos Correa press conference scheduled and then canceled it the morning of. So it's like, there are plenty of people making the jokes like, is this press conference going to, like, no, he's really a Giant. It was a celebratory energy. It was an, oh my God, Rafael Devers is suddenly on the Giants in the middle of June kind of energy. That was emanating from Buster Posey. That was emanating from the owner, Greg Johnson. That was emanating from, honestly, Rafael Devers, who was in great spirits, who was having a damn good time. And in his answers was obviously excited to be on the team and to do what was asked of him, which is interesting for a lot of reasons.
Now, Rafael Devers, I think the videos I saw of like him embracing Willy Adames were really interesting. Because Rafi, as much as I enjoy him, he is not a leader of men. Mm-hmm. He is a obliterator of baseballs. Okay? Yeah. Now, when he signed that big contract, it comes with all these other things, and maybe he should have been more willing to move because of the money. Like, I'm willing to accept that, obviously. Talking to former players, right? That's the main thing they say. But when you see him in this space with that type of traditional leader where Devers doesn't have to wear the backpack full of rocks that is setting an example for the team culture, and he could just roll out of bed with his hair messy, throw on his shoes, and hit baseballs into the body of water, that's the point. That's why the Giants felt comfortable going out to get him, because they think that their specific environment is going to be conducive to Rafi. Now, let's talk about what was said. Most important part of this, really, there are two main things that were said that I took away. One, super resistant to talking about the Red Sox. That's understandable. I want to look forward. I'm not here to talk about the past. It's a new day for me. I don't want to bring that all back up. I get that. I think that in time, he will eventually speak on some of those things.
I think it was as much about that not being the time, like literally like the being up there and celebrating being on the Giants. I think we're going to hear him eventually say more questions. Things. Of course, 100% worth asking.
Yeah.
That did not surprise me. And I didn't take too much of him being like, I don't want to talk about that.
The other one is the positional aspect, right? Where is Rafi Devers going to play defense or not play defense at all? And when asked where he would be willing to play, he said, quote, I am here to play wherever they want me to play. Mm-hmm. And there was some good reporting via Chris Cotillo of Mass Live. Chris Cotillo of Mass Live, who I had a quote from, I believe he called like a Devers confidant. I want to make sure I get the wording correctly. Give me a moment. I apologize.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, again, because a lot of Red Sox people are asking questions, even if Rafael Devers is not answering them directly, there are other people you can ask to understand what Devers' view is on this. I think we start to understand that the reporting that has come out now is it's not Devers not playing first base for the Red Sox was not a principled stance against playing first base. It was not that Rafael Devers had no interest in ever playing first base, no matter what. It was a reflection and a reaction to the communication, to what he viewed as a personal betrayal from the front office, which you can still say, hey, dude, you're being a baby about it. But that is what it was viewed. It was not that like he doesn't think he can play first or that he shouldn't play first. It was that. And so now that all that is gone, it's like, well,
yes.
Giants want to play first. I'll take some grounders first.
So this is from Chris at Mass Live. It's not what you ask, a Devers confidant said Tuesday. It's how you ask it.
Mm-hmm. And so that became very clear. And I think as we've heard, as you mentioned, some former players, David Ortiz speaking very publicly about this situation over the last few years on a variety of platforms. David Ortiz being very clear, being like, they're paying you a ton of money. Like, you got to
when he was like, I viewed it as being an employee. I viewed it as doing what they needed from me. And Devers clearly did not view it like that and viewed this very specific personal relationship with Craig Breslow. I think that's another thing that's so important here. Like, this really did seem to be extremely personal. When he was asked in the weeks, you know, after Costas gets hurt, he's referring specifically in answers to Breslow. I don't know what problem he has with me. I thought he would understand that changing positions in the middle of the year would be hard, referring to Breslow. He was a player, blah, blah, blah. It was very much about him. And so, as you mentioned, it's about how they asked that. Again, if you think that that is a ridiculous way for Rafael Devers to have handled it, that's fine. That's fine. But now as we look forward and we talk about Rafael Devers on the Giants, he's already taken some grounders at first. He DH'd in his first game. Continue to rake, because that's what he does. And it does seem like that we'll start to see him kind of shuffle in at first base and DH moving forward, because they have Matt Chapman.
So a hilarious thing, right, is that the Red Sox are going out there.
They sure are.
To play the Giants. And he's got to play first in one of those games. Like, maybe he's not ready. But you, Giants,
do the right
you have the
thing,
opportunity.
Bob Melvin. Come on.
Do the right thing. Slot him in.
Yeah, so we'll see. We'll see what happens with that. But yeah, I think that, like, as we kind of talked about, just like, how do we get here? Who Devers views as wants, what he wants to be, what he wants to focus on. I think that throughout this whole thing, Devers clearly was just like, look, man, like, I just want to go out there and hit. And he felt like this year he was doing that. Fine. You want me to be a DH? Great. I'll go have the best year of my career, or nearly that. And he thought that, like, if I keep doing this, I will win because I'm doing my job in this sense. Obviously, it turned out that was not the case, but now he can go back to strictly focusing on that. And if you're the Giants and you're a Giants fan and you're Buster Posey, and okay, sure, front offices are anonymously telling you that that contract is going to look terrible in 2031. If the whole purpose of Buster Posey is to get the Giants fans invested in the Giants and feel like they can win every night, then having Rafael Devers on the team is a no-brainer. And him talk about, like, yeah, Rafael Devers is a dude. This is a guy where it's like, this is a game-changing player that you just don't have access to. It's not surprising that they treated it like an absolute, you know, holiday in San Francisco, because it's a huge deal for him to suddenly be on the team.
Let's pivot quickly to the Red Sox Kennedy Breslow stuff.
Sure.
And before we do, I came across this Nesson video from like 4 years ago of Rafi mic'd up during COVID.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I believe it's
I think I know what Hires. You're referring to. Yes. This clip has been shared. If you're on Red Sox Twitter, you've seen this over the years, because it's just an awesome, awesome distillation of Rafael Devers, the human being.
And this is before he signs the extension. Quote, right. They pay me good. I play baseball and I hit homers. And I think this is maybe like a reflection of larger society. Like, not every person is a leader. Not every person is wired to be an example. Rafael Devers seems to have conducted himself imperfectly as a member of the Boston Red Sox over the last few years. The language that was used at the Kennedy Breslow press conference, you could read between the lines, they were, in as many words, saying, we don't want Roman Anthony and Christian Campbell and Marcelo Meyer around Rafael Devers, who is setting a bad example for the rest of the players, right? For what, whether that's attitude or an unwilling to switch positions, that is kind of essentially obviously what was said there, right? But, like, they pay me good, I play baseball and I hit homers. Devers is not a bad guy. He's a very unique type of thing.
Yeah.
He's focused on what he does. And the other thing about Devers that's so important that gets lost in this dude, he posts, brother.
But it's like, games. You could say, oh, well, when you sign that contract, part of that is holding these responsibilities. And it's like, okay, like, you can make that argument. But to me, the reason you're paying anyone like that, the reason you're paying a guy like Vlad that, and I know there's some different off the field context of Vlad that is important, but like, it's because they show up and they hit. And this is one of the hardest things to acquire, is a player that you essentially are guaranteed is going to be a well above average hitter. This is why Juan Soto got $700 million, right? Almost $800 million, right? That's a short list. Rafael Devers is on the short list. He's on the short list. Willie Adames,
like, again, the fact that Willy Adames got nearly $200 million is a product of the market and him being a shortstop and like really having a great season last year. But even when he signed that, everyone was like, I hope it goes, like, I don't know. Like, I hope he's good. I hope we'll see. You know, Rafael Devers, I mean, set it and forget it. The dude just hits. It's such a short list of players and how valuable sure. that is. I don't care what it looks like in 2034. You're trying to win baseball games right now. There are a few hitters you could want more than Rafael Devers.
Forget 2034. The price for that type of player, the like the caliber of superstar that rolls out of bed and rakes. Juan Soto got 765. Vlad Jr. just got 500 flat. Devers has 250 left on the deal, which with deferrals and Jordan Hicks's contract going the other way, probably puts it closer to like 200 to 220-ish.
Whatever.
You're telling me, I'm just saying,
yeah,
let's just say it's 220. I'm with you.
Sure.
Rafael Devers is a free agent right now, is getting more than $220 million. He's probably getting more than $310 million yeah. because the price to acquire that type of player has exponentially increased. And the Giants, in this very bizarre way, are seeing this as a bargain of sorts, I think.
And by the way, I know they have top prospect Bryce Eldridge, who's maybe going to be a first baseman. Some reporting that the Red Sox insisted that they include Bryce Eldridge. It's like, well, that ain't worth
apparently
much
not.
Now. Like, who cares? Like,
clearly not.
Like, usually that's the kind of report that comes out after he gets traded to a different team. where it's like, yeah, well, you know, the Red Sox said they had to give him Bryce Eldridge, so we traded him to the Braves. It's like, no, you still traded him to the Giants.
No.
But I bring him up because, hey, guess what? Here's a very realistic situation. Rafael Devers becomes a decent first baseman. Okay, cool. Now, does that contract look nearly as bad if he's a decent first baseman than if he's a DH every day that the Red Sox had pigeonholed him into being? I don't know. But I don't care about front office's models telling me that the contract's underwater. As I said, it's way simpler than that. The dude hits. He hit immediately last night because that's all he does. He's never, other than his bizarre first week of this season where he looked completely out of sorts, he basically has very, yeah. very rarely ever struggled. And so that is why he is so valuable.
One last interesting thing before we take a break and talk to Jun Lee. Big Poppy speaks. The large father opens his mouth and says some stuff. Who better to speak on this than Big Poppy, honestly? Who could understand what Rafi Devers is going through besides Poppy? Some good stuff over at The Athletic from Ken Rosenthal, who it looks just like just called David Ortiz.
David Ortiz was ready to talk about this. He was saying words a lot in the last 48 hours.
Ortiz generally has been supportive of Devers over the last couple of months as the drama surrounding the positional stuff played out. But I thought what he said the other day was very interesting. I played for the Red Sox a long time. You think everything with me and the Red Sox was roses and flowers? I went through some tough times also, but I was mature enough to understand and keep things internal. Even in the best families, between the best brothers, S happens. You need to have the maturity to resolve the problems and move on. I think he is right in this regard. Mm-hmm. He is right in this regard if Devers' desire was to remain a Red Sox forever, right? If that was the case, Devers failed. Something that I have learned in life is that the most valuable thing often you can do in a conversation is to say, you know what? I'm sorry. I'm wrong. That's my fault. I apologize. Let's move forward, right? I have said that to you many times. Mm-hmm. God knows I've said that to my wonderful wife before.
Yes.
And Devers did not choose to or want to handle the situation in that way, in the way that Ortiz clearly wanted to make it work in Boston. And this gets us back to the stuff about trade demands, trade requests, how Devers looked yesterday in San Francisco. Uh-huh. He never demanded a trade. That has been reported. That has been confirmed by multiple people. I think even Kennedy said this himself, or Breslow said this himself during the press conference, right? But he was still open to the idea, right? He was still open to the idea of playing somewhere else in a way that Ortiz never was. And so while I do think that Ortiz's perspective is valuable here, it's a different enough situation where the priority for Devers was not die in a Red Sox jersey.
No.
It was be happy, pay me good money, hitting homers, play baseball.
It was, I'm going to dig in. If I end up winning this power struggle because they realize I'm one of the best hitters in baseball and they have to suck it up and maneuver the roster around me because I won't play first base, great. If they trade me, great. Because all I care about is, it's you know, whatever, my way or the highway. And he was, you mentioned, he was clearly comfortable with the possibility of getting traded, going somewhere where they said, hey, Rafi, you're awesome. Like, we value you so much and come be, you know, the best hitter on our team. So I think that he, and again, like, that's his right. And maybe at some point down the line, he regrets it. Maybe he, in at some point, he wakes up and be like, man, like, I didn't handle that great. But he's on the Giants now, and that's going to be true for a long time. And maybe it works out great for him. Maybe it works out great for the Red Sox. Long way to go. But that is how, that is really how we got here. And I think that Ortiz's perspective is relevant in that sense, even if he clearly approached it and viewed his time with the Red Sox very differently.
There is just this awesome moment in the game last night where I know the Giants end up losing 3-2 Cleveland, bottom nine, one out, Devers up is the winning run, facing Emmanuel Clase, just hucking, you know, 98
Hundo,
mile cutters.
Hundo, yeah, Hundo heaters. Hundo cutters.
Hundo heaters. Yeah. Hundo cutters. Clase throws one, middle in, Devers, inside out, piss rod into the gap in left center. Single. Easy. Easy. First pitch swinging against Clase. Yes. Now, it wasn't a great location, sure. But it was just like, they cut the Devers at first base. He's got a, you know, tobacco wad the size of a hawk in his mouth.
No one's dipping harder than Rafi, man. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it was just like, and that's the thing. It's just like, simplify this. You were about to hear a conversation that we have with June Lee about how we got here from the Red Sox perspective and the big picture of the interaction between the ownership and the front office and the fans and what it means to be a Red Sox fan and what is important when you're a Red Sox fan and why you stay a Red Sox fan through all this nonsense and all these things. But like, it's so simple. If you're the Giants, it's like, oh my God, Rafael Devers is on the team. It's, think about how much more watchable the Giants are now, knowing how well they pitch. Oh, well, at least Devers is going to come up at some point. I mean, we already felt that in the first game. I mean, watching the Giants recently, it's like, okay, who's going to do something on this Giants lineup, in this Giants lineup?
Yeah.
No, right? Like, Jungwoo Lee is really fun, but you don't really know that he's going to do something. You know, Willy Adames, when he's going, okay. Devers, oh yeah, he'll get a hit. That's, oh my gosh, what a feeling that must be. So, Giants fans, congratulations. Red Sox fans, I think Roman Anthony's going to be pretty good, but the chance that he has, you know, 500 extra base hits before he turns 29 feels pretty low. And that is why this is a difficult day, difficult time, difficult week in Boston. Let's take a break. When we return, we will talk to the great June Lee about his story about the Boston Red Sox on Yahoo Sports. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. What a treat this is to be joined by our good friend and colleague for the week, June Lee, who wrote a wonderful story on our lovely website, Yahoo Sports, about the Boston Red Sox. June, we have, of course, reacted to this massive Rafael Devers trade earlier this week. And now we're kind of zooming even farther out. You know, we had the press conferences from Boston, from San Francisco, and those are plenty interesting on their own. But I think as we bring you on here on this podcast to talk about your story, I do think it is important that we focus on the big picture. And I think you did a good job of that. So let's start there. Before we get to any of the specifics of the story, someone who knows this franchise well, even leading up to this massive decision, How long has this really kind of been building? I guess it's a good way, both the story and just this moment in Red Sox history.
I would say that this dates back to 2019, where all of the speculation around the Mookie Betts situation started, and people were wondering, is this guy going to be here long term? Especially after Dave Dombrowski had gone out after the World Series championship and spent a ton of money. And the salary situation in the eyes of John Henry was kind of out of control. And I think when you kind of look back at where the Red Sox were at that point, they were kind of at a crossroads as Henry was really starting to grow his international ambitions for Fenway Sports Group and the need generally to have more cash on hand for him to be able to do that, to be able to support multiple major sports franchises across leagues. And so as that was happening, you know, the Mookie situation was coming to a head and a lot of speculation was kind of getting out there about whether or not Mookie wanted to be in Boston, whether or not he, you know, whether, you know, he wanted to be somewhere else. And you know, I think when I remember talking to Mookie basically every single day during that 2019 season, and he always made it clear to me that like Boston was the only thing that he had known at that point and he wanted to stay. And the Red Sox, despite him being the best homegrown prospect that they've developed since Ted Williams, had not really expressed that same sentiment. And I think that that has kind of set the tone for where we are today, where this is a once in a generation guy. Mookie has gone on to kind of prove himself to be a first ballot Hall of Famer and one of the best players of this generation. And I think from there, the fact that John Henry did not plan around the idea of keeping Mookie in Boston has led to this domino effect where they have been, you know, trying to model the Dodgers organization. They brought in Chaim Bloom to kind of do that. Chaim, for one reason or another, was not the best at executing that on the timeline that I think Boston expects for winning. And in comes Craig Breslow. And, you know, this dysfunction has kind of continued, you know, from Mookie to Xander Bogaerts to Rafael Devers, where, you know, across, you know, chief baseball officers, there hasn't been very good communication with the best players on their team. And so this is not just a Craig Breslow issue or a Chaim Bloom issue or a Dave Dombrowski issue. This is a like John Henry, Sam Kennedy, state of Red Sox ownership conversation, because there just doesn't seem to be a cohesive vision where they kind of keep flipping back and forth between, okay, we're going to press the gas pedal to try to win now. Okay, well, actually, now we're going to just play for the future. And like, you could always play for the future, you know? Like, and so I think the Red Sox fans, more so than being frustrated about not winning, are almost more frustrated now at this point after the Devers trade about being just like kind of, you know, whiplashed back and forth about what the direction of this team is for the future.
Right. In that sense of confusion and disappointment, in my opinion, underscores the lack of understanding of what fans want and how fans follow a team. And obviously the winning is the be all and the end all. And if Kyle Harrison turns out to be, you know, Gen Z Randy Johnson, then like, we'll all look stupid. That's probably not going to happen. Right. Whatever.
Yeah.
If they win, it's all fine. That's always the case. I want to hop back to something you said about John Henry and his global ambitions, because I think so. He owns Liverpool is the big one. And I think it is easy to look at Liverpool spending £150 million on a winger or whatever, and saying, well, you got to open that money up somewhere in the books. In your understanding, how interconnected are the various components of the John Henry Fenway Sports Group global sports empire from a financial standpoint?
I think the perception of it in the public is not entirely correct, because people think that like they traded Devers to sign Florian Wirtz. And I say this as both a Red Sox fan, as a Liverpool fan, it's been a very weird confluence of emotions the last few days around the moves Fenway Sports Group are making. I think that this is more reflective of how John Henry is very focused on the mega macro of where sports is right now. I mean, I actually wrote a column in the New York Times about this, about how sports is kind of getting paywalled and fractured for the fan experience. And, you know, I think that he's actually done a very good job of putting Fenway Sports Group in a place where they don't need to take a huge lump sum of private equity money, because that's where the Boston Celtics are. They just sold for $6.1 billion. And initially, the sale was majority financed by a private equity firm called Sixth Street. And Fenway Sports Group is not in that place. And I think that that's something that Red Sox fans probably don't appreciate right now, but will probably appreciate more 5 to 10 years down the line. That being said, you know, the difference in how Liverpool is run versus how Fenway, how the Red Sox are run, excuse me, is drastically different at the current moment, because Michael Gordon is the guy who runs Liverpool. And, you know, Jurgen Klopp was a guy that he hired. Liverpool had great success under Jurgen Klopp. They brought in Arne Slot from, you know, from the Netherlands. He came in, they won a Premier League immediately. You know, they've, I think as a result, feel the momentum of the Premier League in the United States, which according to a poll from Seton Hall, for, you know, basically guys our age, you know, sports fans under the age of 35, the EPL and Major League Baseball are basically neck and neck in popularity. You know, there's a big generation gap between us and like older people. But for people our age, it's basically neck and neck right now, which is kind of crazy given, you know, where soccer was in terms of popularity when we were growing up. Liverpool is an extremely well-run organization for the most part. You know, if I'm not a Mo Salah fan and I'm thinking about Mo Salah as like a business asset, the way that they handled that negotiation, they probably got him for the best deal possible. You know, it's kind of similar to how the Red Sox handled David Ortiz throughout the course of his entire career, where I think they almost exploited his loyalty to the franchise. Now, on the flip side, Sam Kennedy is the person who runs the Boston Red Sox. And we have seen him put out this kind of salesman pitch. And I like Sam interpersonally. He is a very, very nice guy. He's also a Brookline native. I'm from Brookline, Massachusetts. You know, I've known him dating back to when I was in college. Like he gave me an interview for my podcast when I think I was a sophomore in college. Like Sam is a very, very nice guy. That being said, I think he's completely bungled communication with the franchise, with the fan base for going on 5-6 years now, where he's almost unable to kind of be frank with people and is always trying to put a positive spin on it. And as a result, like fans, you know, especially in Boston, kind of, they're smart. They smell through the BS. They smell through the spin. And, you know, I think we've seen this kind of whiplash in priorities for the organization where, you know, they let go of Heim because he wasn't building a quote unquote sustainable, you know, efficient organization fast enough. They bring in Breslow, you know, Devers is signed to this extension, you know, Alex Cora pushes the team to, you know, sign Bregman this season, Alex Bregman this season, to try to push for, you know, a playoff spot. You know, if you watch the Red Sox Netflix documentary, in the last episode, Alex Cora says, he says that I'm really excited to compete for something bigger than a wild card next season. That's kind of shows you the motivation behind why he was trying to sign. He pushed the team to sign Alex Bregman. When you kind of put all those things together, and then you see the Rafael Devers trade, you like that by itself kind of illustrates like, oh, these groups are not on the same page in the first place. And so this whiplash is just throwing everyone for a spin. And obviously winning solves everything, but this is a bigger macro issue than just one season.
I want to ask about the dynamic and the relationship between continuity and change here. Because something that has been said in regards to the Devers trade is, well, hey, that contract was signed under Chaim Bloom. And Chaim Bloom said that you could play third base. And now Craig Breslow is in charge and we're going to operate slightly differently. Now, that's one bucket. The other bucket, and you talked about this in your story, is the level of continuity that has existed in the organization beneath whoever the chief baseball officer are. That there are people in baseball operations that span these various regimes, right? And that is also the case in regards to Kennedy, who has been above Dombrowski, who has been above Bloom, who is now above Breslow.
Who is a childhood best friend of Theo Epstein, by the way.
Okay, that's adorable. And so I am interested in how those two things interact, where it seems like there are people who have been there for a long, long time, both above and below the true decision maker in terms of baseball operations. So like, do you see the dynamic? I just want to hear your thoughts on this. Like, you can't say, oh, well, this is a whole new guy. It's a whole new world where you can't have it both ways is essentially what I'm trying to get at, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the Red Sox have prided themselves on being ahead of the curve. Like, you know, Moneyball was about the Oakland A's, but I think the Red Sox were actually the team that executed on that Moneyball vision, you know, in the 2000s better than anyone else. You know, being able to find that balance between the analytics and kind of the human, you know, touch experience of all of that. And I think that's why the team has kind of prided itself on not just having continuity in the front office, but also on the field, like the security guards, like the, you know, all the staff there have been there for, you know, multiple decades. Like, this is something that the Red Sox really do pride themselves on. And I think Breslow coming in, bringing in this consulting firm Sportsology to basically do a McKinsey style consulting, you know, audit of the organization. They ended up firing a ton of their scouting staff, a lot of their front office as a result. And from everything I've heard, the analytics team drastically outnumbers the scout team now. And that is a shift from even the Heim Bloom era. Like, this is something that is new under Craig Breslow, is that they're way more reliant on analytics than scouts. And they outnumber them, I think one person told me, by almost a 4-to-1 margin.
And to be clear, like, they are not alone in that. Right, I think that is important for listeners to understand. This is something that has happened in other organizations as technology has been almost, you know, more prevalent within the game. Teams are reducing their scouting departments in a way that is concerning, in a way that I do think is detrimental. But the Red Sox are not alone in that regard. Jordan?
The thing I wanted to get at too is, because I know we keep saying like, oh, well, winning fixes everything, but I do want to get back to the on-field results, because I think that the one part of the press conference that I definitely wanted to kind of throw at you, June, that I found so interesting is when Sam Kennedy kind of defended the record of the Red Sox, right?
Yeah.
By saying, like, listen, you know, this is all this drama, but like, I'll put up our record against anyone. We've won more World Series this century than anyone else. And it's true, right? That's true. But based on you
not after
designating
this year when the Giants win with Rafael Devers.
Well, okay, so let's as we bring it back to the current moment, and your reference earlier to how 2019 kind of marking this change, you know, right after their most recent World Series, you know, they had another postseason appearance after that, but as I wrote about, as in my kind of like what's next for the Red Sox, like, this is why this is about this season and is a critical moment, because that credibility is at risk now, not just because of yet another move that is trading away a star player, which is a huge part, but also that if they miss the postseason this year, that's the first time since 1994 that they've missed the playoffs 4 years in a row. And so that's where we get to a point where it's like, okay, why am I supposed to trust you? Even if you and the ownership group have overseen a lot of this success, we are now moving farther and farther away from that. And I think that's where the trust is being lost. And I think it's also relevant that, like, you're in Boston. Everybody wins all the time. Like, this isn't a city where you can just get away with sucking for, you know, lengthy stretches. And so I think that context.
No, but you
also
can, though.
Also,
you
being
can
lost,
get away with that because the money stays printed.
Well, but again, it's the vision of what is the goal. And this is getting back to what June is saying, is what is the goal of owning the Red Sox? What are the priorities of John Henry? And the fact that, as you mentioned, since the Mookie thing, it feels like we've been prioritizing things that are different than, I want the best baseball players on my team. But also, to your point, June, the whiplash of, didn't we just trade for Garrett Crochet and sign Alex Bregman? Like, that felt like a win now move. So
yeah,
I guess I'm just curious your perspective of like how now we're moving farther away from that credibility, even though they have built a lot of it over the years.
Well, I think you guys both make important points here, because I think that what Henry is setting a model for within the context of this international growth situation across not just Major League Baseball, but all sports. This is a conversation I have with people at the NBA, people who are close to the NFL, about where American sports is heading in the future. And this is, I think, conversation that's happening in D.C. as well, because of the implications of soft power abroad because of American sports' power. So I think the thing that John Henry is setting an example for owners across sports, is that the way to have as much cash as possible is to figure out how to monetize the loyalty of your fans. Mm. The Red Sox are exploiting the loyalty of their fans to make money right now, because Boston will ride with the team up or down. Up until this moment, will ride with the team up and down, you know, through the wins and losses, because, you know, they believe in the team. I think the Red Sox really are you know, the heart and soul of the city historically. The Patriots are the most popular team in town. But when you kind of like, when the Red Sox won on Sunday, they swept the Yankees. My fiance and I were walking downtown in the Public Garden. And I asked her, like, Boston feels different right now, right? And she was like, yeah, just like it feels lighter. Like the weather was perfect, but like you can really sense the energy. Everyone was like wearing Red Sox shirts. They just come from Fenway Park. Like the vibe of the city was just completely different. And that's the thing that John Henry, I think, has correctly identified as the owner of the Pittsburgh Penguins, you know, a team that has a similar relationship to the city of Pittsburgh and with Liverpool, that that is a kind of business advantage that he has over most other sports owners and why he doesn't need private equity money in the same way. So that's one point. I think the second thing is we are at a tipping point, I think, with the Red Sox fan credibility with this organization. People don't believe anything that comes out of the mouth of Sam Kennedy or Craig Breslow in any way, shape, or form. And I will say, like, the fact that people within the organization and people around the organization are willing to come to me with like internal politics level, like pettiness, knowing that it could reach the public, speaks to how dysfunctional and how much of a lack of trust exists within the organization. I think to hop on to Jordan, I think you really correctly identify that comment from Sam, because it almost felt like Sam was trying to sell the Red Sox brand nationally. Like he was trying to spin the national reporters almost more than he was trying to like speak to fans. And I think it speaks to the mindset that the Red Sox organization feels towards the fans right now, which is that they think that the fans are entitled and that they're not patient enough. And to be fair, Boston sports fans across the board are incredibly impatient. I say this myself, but there's been a really high standard for winning for a very, very long time. And people expect that to happen. People have been patient with this Roman Anthony, Marcelo Meyer, and now Christian Campbell as of kind of last year, and with Kyle Teal before he was traded to the White Sox. They've been very patient for the last 4 years because the Red Sox have been like, the future is coming. This is the face of our franchise. Just wait. It's going to get great. And it felt like this year with the Crochet trade, with the Bregman signing, that, okay, they're going all in on the season. They're going to try to make a big push. And Devers is going to be, you know, a central part of that. And so that's where the credibility kind of like doesn't feel like it's real anymore. And I think that the reaction locally yesterday among the media pundits and a lot of fans that I talked to is that that comment from Sam Kennedy came from the mindset of feeling like Red Sox fans are entitled. It was received as entitled from Sam Kennedy. Like they are entitled to the loyalty of fans because of how good they are and how good they've been. And I think that that antagonistic stance towards the fan base is a huge reason why they're in this situation right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is why, as you mentioned, it is a key, a kind of a tipping point with the organization in a macro sense. And that's why I do think that like this season on the field is important. And what happens from here moving forward is really fascinating, because you are in a situation where, I mean, we've even seen it in the last 48 hours, right? You know, the first game after Roman Anthony homers, they beat the Mariners, and it's like, oh, screw it. We're all the way back in. We got these rookies. They're going to carry us to the postseason. And then last night, you know, they get their ass kicked, and it's like, oh, never mind. We got to go back. And that's part of just what the Red Sox experience is. And you could also just say that's baseball. It's baseball fandom. It's also all relative. And I think that the context of the franchise, the success of the century, the context of the city and the fan base that they're used to cheering on all their teams that generally are winning all the time. Of course, if you're a Pirates fan or you're a Rockies fan or you're a Marlins fan, you're like, I'll take these Red Sox problems any day. Are you kidding me? Like, I'd love to have still all these good players, even if you are trading away Rafael Devers. But you have to look at it in the context of the org and the history. And I think that you've correctly identified that we are at a very important part of that history.
I think it's so much simpler than that. And this is kind of my last thought for you, June, is the case with Devers, the case with Betts. When you have a generational talent, a future Hall of Fame type guy, the goal should be to keep that player for the entirety of their career. And what I am interested in is that the Red Sox, in the afterglow of everything that David Ortiz was to the organization, have not been able to recognize that. Now, Devers, as a personality, is not David Ortiz, right? Just because they are both huggable Dominican DHs that rake, right? Like, Poppy always had a little bit more. social interpersonal feel than I think Devers has. He was outgoing. Devers is a lot more introverted.
Introverted. Right?
But still, the inability to recognize or to prioritize, the lack of desire to prioritize that franchise cornerstone in the afterglow of the Ortiz era. Do you think that is a mistake? Even if they win moving forward, are fans going to be willing to commit to these young players if they think that Anthony or Meyer or Campbell is going to get dealt when they get expensive?
It's a great question, because this was one of the things I was talking about yesterday when I was appearing on local sports television here. And the fact that Roman Anthony, on his second day in the big leagues, was trotted out by the coaching staff to make a point about how fundamentals are not being taught well in the minor leagues is not a great sign for the start of Roman Anthony's career at the major league level. If I'm Roman Anthony, I'm not sure if he's thinking this far ahead, but like, if I'm Roman Anthony, I look at the way that the Red Sox have treated Xander Bogaerts, Mookie Betts, and Rafael Devers, and I'm like, wait a minute. They're telling me that I'm going to be the face of the franchise here. And when you look at the last three faces of the franchise, this is how they've been shipped out of here. This is how they've treated me. And already on day two, he's being used as a political pawn between the front office and the coaching staff. That is not a great sign. And when you have that situation happen, and then on top of that, you have 4 years of hype from all levels of the organization that the future of the franchise hinges on your development, your success. It's a lot of pressure, especially in Boston. Like, there's a national spotlight on these guys now to be good. Like, it's not just like, you know, coming up with, you know, the Arizona Diamondbacks and, you know, having to turn that franchise around. There's not the same level of national attention that these Red Sox prospects have. And so I think when you put them in that situation, it's tough, because like, when you look at the glory days of the Red Sox kind of being able to develop guys and sign these big free agents through the 2000s and into the 2010s, with guys like Bogaerts, with guys like Jacoby Ellsbury, with Dustin Pedroia, John Lester, they were kind of brought into these bit roles and they kind of grew into stardom. Mookie Betts went up and down from the minor leagues twice before he actually stuck it out in the major leagues. Right now, they're called up, and within a week of Roman Anthony being in the major leagues, they're like, okay, now you're the face of the franchise, you know? Like, that's kind of an insane expectation to have on a team in Boston. And so I think that there's just like this, I believe that it caps the ceiling of a team when you're not able to handle the things that come with a superstar. You know, people, you guys both spend enough time around baseball. The Dodgers spend a lot of time making sure that Shohei Ohtani is happy. None of that stuff like really comes out in the media, you know?
But maybe,
like,
too much time, but yes.
They spend a lot of time making sure Shohei Ohtani is happy and making sure that he's comfortable doing what he does. But no one calls him a diva, you know? All Devers was asking for is, hey, can you be upfront with me with whether or not you're going out and chasing Alex Bregman and Nolan Arenado this offseason? And
they couldn't do it. They failed.
And that alone led to the front office, you know, leaking out to some of the local press, in my eyes, that Devers was a diva. Yeah. And, you know, Devers didn't handle the situation nearly as well as he could have. But
right.
I think that kind of antagonistic mindset, not just towards your players, but the fans, it speaks to just where the organization is.
And I think that's a good place to leave it, because I think your point about how it might be impacting the next generation of players and how it would make a player like Roman Anthony feel, I think that's relevant and an interesting perspective, but it's about the fan experience, ironically, right? And the what you're referring to of that, knowing that the Red Sox fans are going to keep coming back because that's who they are, but also knowing that, like, they now can't trust that the guy that they have at the top is going to be happy. And by the way, like, this is opening up a whole can of worms, but like, I am fascinated about how you would view this, even if you're a new guy like Garrett Crochet and Alex Bregman. And I know they said they're going to say all the right things and they're going to say, Garrett Crochet, oh yeah, we're moving forward, and that's fine. And like, yeah, I don't blame him. I'm not saying he should say anything different. But that part is pretty amazing, because it's extremely realistic that Alex Bregman isn't on the team next year. And like, then where are you at? And that's also an amazing outcome, I think, is another kind of remarkable part, because you thought that Devers was the piece you had, and Now you don't. June Lee, this was a delight. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for writing this cool story for Yahoo Sports. Cool to see you contributing, and we look forward to having you on to talk about the Red Sox maybe for more optimistic reasons at some point in the future. So thanks for the time, June.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. If you absolutely hate Rafael Devers and the Giants and the Red Sox and everything we've been talking about, I have good news, because time to talk about Shohei Ohtani pitching.
We know that the first couple games in this Dodgers-Padres series has gotten a little chippy. Had some bean balls. Ohtani got hit last night. Schilt's mad. Roberts is pissed. I'll be honest, we're not really watching it because we're busy doing other things that we're going to talk about after this Shohei Ohtani pitching segment. So again, transparent, maybe we'll hit more of it on Friday after that series wraps up. Let's focus on the important thing, which is that Shohei Ohtani is pitching again. We saw it happen. He recorded statistics. His baseball reference page now has him as a pitcher again in 2025. Oh, so nice to see. I wrote a couple graphs about this over Yahoo, just kind of analyzing how he looked and what it felt like to watch him pitch again. What was your experience and what were your takeaways from his 28-pitch first inning in which he allowed one run and struck nobody out but was throwing very hard?
He was throwing very hard.
Sure was. Is that the main take? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do from one inning? His arm didn't implode, and then he had, I believe, two hits later on in the day, and
yes,
that's great. If he's going to be opening, I would expect the velo to be a little bit higher than we're used to with him,
yeah,
because the finish line is closer, so he's going to empty the tank a little bit more.
Yeah, I will say that I think it is totally plausible he would have thrown a second inning if it had gone a little smoother. We know the pitch count was up to 40, 50 pitches in live BP, and there wasn't really a reason to throttle down that much. So even if he's not expected to throw 5 or 6 or 7, I think that it's, I don't think they're just going to limit him to one inning. If he goes out there next time out and throws a 1, 2, 3 and 10 pitches, I think he's going to go back out for the second, maybe even go for the third. So we'll see. I think from a stuff standpoint, yeah, he was throwing really hard. The command was obviously all over the place. The one thing from a pitch mix standpoint that stood out to me, and on the one hand, it's like 28 pitches, that's not nothing, but like 28 pitches is a lot more than 10 pitches. And the fact that he threw basically even four seamers and sinkers, I thought was interesting. Now, it's possible that he was so amped up and was just gripping and ripping it and wasn't really intentionally trying to throw sinkers and fastballs. But
sure,
based on the Dodgers introducing some sinkers with certain pitchers, Ohtani didn't start really throwing a sinker in games until 2022, and in 2023, he threw it about 6% of the time. If he starts kind of doing more of the two fastball thing, which is very, very popular in baseball right now, it wouldn't surprise me, and I'm very intrigued to see that pitch more often, because like all of his other pitches, it has pretty ridiculous movement, and we really haven't seen it that much from him. So only saw one splitter, bunch of sweepers. I mean, he threw more sweepers than fastballs in 2023, so it wasn't surprising to see that. But, you know, it's just cool to see. Like, obviously, the command was a mess, but he's, you know, talent, just pure mound talent. He's in the top 10 in the world, you know. I forget that he's one of the best hitters in the world. Like that, if you just watched him, you'd be like, oh my God, that's some of the best stuff in the world. It's like, oh yeah, right, of course. So that was fun. I enjoyed that.
He only threw one inning though. Yep. I saw a guy throw 9 innings here in Omaha, Nebraska.
You sure did. All right, Jake, let's talk about it. Gage Wood, a name that now a lot more people know than before Monday afternoon. What did this man, this 6-foot right-hander from Arkansas, what did he do on Monday?
It's what he didn't do. He did not allow a hit. He threw a no-hitter in the College World Series, striking out, I believe, 19 batters.
Yep.
It is the only blemish on the record was a hit by pitch that doinked off a batter's foot on like a curve.
He was not happy about that.
Not happy about it. He said that was what. In the post game, this was the most performative BS. Like, awesome kid. happy for Gage Wood. How is your outing? What do you have to say? And he's like, shouldn't hit that guy. It's like, all right, brother. Like, come on. Like, you threw no hitters, struck out 90 guys in Omaha.
First, but it was awesome. And I will, first College World Series no hitter in 65 years. So that's pretty cool.
So it's the third College World Series no hitter ever. One in 1960, one in 1950. The one in 1950 was against Tufts, which is incredible. You're just now a D3 program.
Also,
that makes me so happy.
Was it even in Omaha in 1960?
Yeah.
Okay. When did it? Oh, it moved in the 50s? Anyway, this was amazing. And it wasn't just like some guy having a good day. It was kind of the culmination of an interesting spring for Gage Wood, where he has a lot of talent, has been a reliever at Arkansas the last 2 years, has this amazing fastball, dealt with injuries to start the season, and has, you know, been back in the rotation for the last month or so. It's been a little uneven, had a couple good outings, had a couple bad outings. And I mean, God bless Murray State. What a story. But poor Murray State hadn't seen a lot of pitchers like Gage Wood this season. So that was very apparent. This is not to take anything away from Gage Wood, but, you know, when you say you're pitching a 19 strikeout no hitter in Omaha, you kind of normally assume it's like, oh, well, he did it against one of the other best teams. I love Murray State, but again, it's just like not something that they probably saw this season. That said, holy crap. I mean, that kind of that level of fastball dominance was special, and 19 strikeouts in any situation is special. And I think Gage Wood now has meaningfully changed or reminded people that he belongs in the first round, even though he comes with a lot of risk for a lot of reasons. So, but what was anything else from the scene? Because I was watching on the plane, kind of a weird experience to watch an event like that.
My experience was even weirder because Paul Skeens showed up in Omaha because it was his off day with the Pirates. He was here with Henry Davis, his catcher, who played at Louisville, and so he went to go hang out with the Louisville guys. And Skeens was going across the street to do like an event at the bar Rocco's where the Jello shots are, and this was happening like right as the end of the game. And my responsibility was to go cover Skeens and talk to Skeens, and so I left in the seventh inning. And I missed the end of this, and I am not happy about it.
But you're honest about it, which I think is most important on this podcast.
But I'm honest about it. So. Honesty is important. But anyway, I'm here in Omaha. I'm going home today. I'll be writing up some draft prospects from here, guys that stood out. Jordan, you're at the Combine. I assume will do the same at some point. Yeah. How are things down in Phoenix?
Yeah, so toasty. It's crisp, you know, 115. Fortunately, the Chase Field roof is closed and it is quite comfortable inside there. But yeah, it's cool. I'm excited to be back here. I know last year we kind of blew it out more. We had camera crew there. We recorded a bunch of podcasts. It's a little more low key. Interviewing a bunch of guys. You'll see some of those stories kind of written up in the coming weeks leading up to the draft. Yesterday I talked to a couple of the potential first round high school guys, and that's a big trend of this year's class. It's just a lot more really high level high school players, and you'll see that. I'll have my top 50 draft prospects coming out in the next couple of weeks. So just talking to scouts, talking to people around the game about trying to sort through these kids. And as I always tell you, like, and you know this, we feel this at the Futures game, we feel this in Omaha, the biggest value is just seeing all the best players stand next to each other. And especially at the high school level, understanding the physicality for them is, I think, the most instructive and understanding, because you just reading the scouting report and seeing, oh, they're 6'1", 180. Oh, because there are multiple players listed at 6'1", 180 that look very different. and that is important when you're projecting whether they're going to play shortstop, whether they're going to hit for power, whether they can, X, Y, Z. And so I am no scout. I love the amateur space. I think it's really interesting, but that is so important. And seeing, especially yesterday, it was a really stronger crop than recent years of some of the top high school players taking BP. It was really cool to see that. So a whole long day today. I got a bunch more interviews lined up, and maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that on Friday. And of course, I'll write about some of the specifics, but glad I'm here. It's been cool. And I hope I can provide a helpful look at the 2025 draft, which I am quite excited about. So that's that. I am flying home tomorrow. So Friday, we'll be back with a normal show. We'll give you the good, the bad, the ugly. again, when we're traveling like this, we're trying to focus on what we're looking at in front of our eyes. There is stuff happening in games that is very interesting, and we'll get to that later this week. So sorry if we did not cover that. We understand the Rockies keep winning and the Nationals keep losing, and there's plenty of national stuff we could talk about, but we'll get to all that later this week. So thank you to June Lee. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and TJ Brassel for producing. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com, and we will talk to you all later this week. Bye-bye.